We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Hello, everybody. It is the 19th of March, 2022. I was originally planning to be calling this in from the Dallas Makerspace because my anime club meeting happens monthly in, you know, noon to 5 p.m. local time on the Saturday, but I was not feeling well enough to drive for an hour. Last time I drove to Dallas when I was feeling iffy, I wound up having an unpleasant experience a couple of hours later, which I would really not like to repeat. So, what is there to say? Well, if you listened to Hear Now the Words yesterday, you will have heard a transcription of a set of records which was given away by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission at the 1971 Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. If not, you can go back, listen to the archive. That is, of course, just one of a number of pieces of nuclear energy-related media which I have accumulated recently. I've bought a number of films. I've got one in the German language about fusion research, the Wendelstein Stellarator. I've got several in the French language. I've also got four in the Russian language, which I bought from a fellow in Ivano-Frankivsk in western Ukraine. Three of them have arrived here. The fourth one, well, I hope it does arrive. I hope. Postal services, as you can imagine, are a bit iffy from Ukraine right at the moment. So, as usual, you know, that stuff costs money to transfer to video. And so if anybody wants to help me towards the expense, you know, I'm always happy to receive your contributions. You can always send me something at Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. You can also send your cards and letters commenting on my programs to that address, and I really appreciate that. Very likely to read them out on the air. There's also paypal.me/PrometheusLives as another option for that. Anyway, now that I've got the shameless begging out of the way, going to start the show proper with something that SDF member DC Trud said the other day. He was mentioning something called clotted cream, sometimes referred to as Devonshire clotted cream. The West Country of England and Cornwall sort of argue about who it really belongs to. But the important part is you cannot get it in the United States. Period. End of sentence. Why is this? Well, simply because the way it's made, you have to start with raw milk, unpasteurized milk, and then you heat it gently until the cream forms blobs that float to the surface. And then you skim those blobs off, and that's your clotted cream. And in Britain, there are people who think they have good enough hygiene in their dairies that you can actually do that. And whether or not that's really true is an interesting question. But suffice to say that for legal reasons, it would not be allowed in the U.S., and it is entirely possible that standards of hygiene in American dairies are not as high as in British dairies. Although, again, even a high standard of hygiene is not necessarily proof against things like listeriosis. But it led me to think, would radio-pasteurized milk clot the same way? Could we, assuming that radio-pasteurization were approved as a method of treating milk for the market here in the United States, which it should be, right, but assuming it were approved on an equal footing with heat pasteurization, could we do that with radio-pasteurized milk? And I would really like to find out. Now, why do I mention this? Well, I mention it because you're liable to say, well, that's your solution for everything. And it's not. Really, it isn't. I mean, I've told you in the past, beware of the people who have only one solution for everything. I mean, obviously, I talk about the people who, whatever the problem is, wind and solar power are their answer to everything. Even if you're asking very different questions, they've only got the one answer. But let's take a look at a few others. I mean, here's a great example. The world's central banks are rushing to raise interest rates in order to stave off inflation. Why? Well, for much of the past 30 years, honestly, interest rates have been very, very, very low, which is supposed to encourage economic growth and investment. And it hasn't worked. Sure, we've got new billionaires practically every day over that interval, but as far as investment in infrastructure, investment in capital plant, investment in the things that actually, you know, employ people and give income to the, you know, working class and all that, it hasn't happened. But they've persisted in doing it on the pretense that they have, you know, that this is what works, even though there's no evidence to show that it does work, right? This is all preconceptions out of Keynes' general theory of money and prices, that you can lower interest rates and it will cause economic growth, but with accompanying inflation, and then when the inflation gets too bad, you raise interest rates and that causes the economy to cool off. Well, the fact is the economy right now doesn't need cooling off. The rise in prices is not due to massive surges in demand. It's due to commodity price spikes, shortages of supply. The only way to really cool off demand enough to make any dent in prices is to precipitate the world into a general depression, which is sure to cause social unrest. And, of course, the whole idea of the managed economy where we try to maintain a stable level of prices and employment is to avoid social unrest, because social unrest leads to billionaires having the windows of their private cars smashed in and being dragged out into the streets and set on fire. It's possible that this show should have come with a trigger warning for anti-capitalistic violence or something, but I'm willing to headway that. Rulli says, beware of the man with one book. That's a good thing. Yes, whether the book is the Bible or Keynes' general theory of money and prices or Marx's Kapital, although that's like five books, it's still true. So what might actually help? Well, I mean, the biggest thing that would have helped would have been more investment earlier on, because the commodity price spikes we're seeing are due in large part, I would say, to a chronic underinvestment, which has led to, you know, and leaning of industry, which has led to an inability to actually serve the demand that's there. So really, whatever solution you were going to put in place, it should have been put in place several years ago in order to have any effect now, because things like mines and so on, typically it's at least 3 to 5 years between when you sign on the dotted line and when they actually begin delivering something to the world market that affects world market prices, you know, supply and demand shifts. But what would work? Well, one thing I think would probably help is a prohibition on share buybacks, because large corporations have been putting immense sums of money into share buybacks in recent years. It has been pointed out, for example, that adjusted for inflation, the only thing IBM has spent anything like the amount of money they spent on the System 360, developing and implementing the System 360, the only thing IBM has spent that kind of money on in the past generation has been share buybacks. Now, obviously, that doesn't solve everything. And I would say another part of it is probably to raise capital gains taxes at least to the point where they are equal to taxes on other forms of income. Why? Well, when capital gains taxes are very low, it's supposed to encourage investment, but what it really seems to do is encourage people to buy something that already exists, jack the price up, and sell it for a higher price. It does not encourage people to put large sums of money into projects which have a high initial investment but pay off in the form of income over 20, 30, 50, 100 years. And that's the kind of investment that we really need. We need investment in research and development. We need investment in capital plant. You know, that's what will make for a better and not simply a bigger world economy. Yeah, that's the kind of growth that could ultimately be called sustainable. And it's certainly true that if we're going to move toward, you know, the circular economy or what have you, we're going to need very large investments in new capital plant. Another thing I'm not going to claim that I can solve with nuclear energy or even space travel, the French pension problem. So in France, they're having a big political hoo-ha right now. Is that the word? Maybe a to-do? Not a chivalry. Anyway, perhaps it's a contretemps. Anyway, they're having a big political flap right now over proposals to raise the retirement age. Why? Well, it's often stated people are living longer, therefore people have to work longer. But that only makes sense if there are jobs for them to do. And already in recent years, we've seen efforts to reduce pay and benefits and job security for younger workers in order to make them more attractive to employers to hire. So if there aren't enough jobs already for young people, then keeping the older people working longer will only exacerbate the problem, won't it? I mean, if you're going to raise the retirement age, I guess you also have to cut the working week back to 4 days or maybe three, because otherwise, all young people will be unemployed. There just aren't enough jobs. So if the real underlying problem is simply that the French can't fund their pension system, maybe we should ask how that came about. And I'm going to point a finger here. At the fact that the proportion of French national wealth represented by the 100 largest fortunes has absolutely ballooned in the past generation. Maybe if they're going to need to do something drastic to fund their pension system, confiscatory taxation on large fortunes might be the way to do it. And frankly, if you're smart, you'll remember what happened in 1789 and think, yes, I would rather have the top 50% of my fortune shaved off than everything above my shoulders. So there is a thought. Is it a good thought? I don't know. But again, I'm not trying to solve that problem with nuclear power or space travel. I don't think either of those really is a solution. Not in this case. Another problem that I'm not going to claim to be able to solve with nuclear power and space travel is the Canadian-Indian paper problem. Now, you've probably never heard of this. I think I was reading about it in the Grawny ad. The point is this. Canada is a physically large country with a fairly small population. Much of its territory is wooded, and therefore it is a large producer and exporter of wood and wood products, everything from Christmas trees to paper pulp. India is a large country with a large population. And it has some forested area, but it is in a desperate race to conserve as much of that forest as possible against all forms of encroachment, including not only people cutting wood, cutting trees for fields, cutting trees to get wood for building, cutting wood for charcoal. And so India can't really supply its own paper pulp. Canada is a wealthy country. India is not a wealthy country. Canadians, being a fairly wealthy people on average, consume a lot of paper products, everything from paperback novels to toilet paper, and everything in between, paper plates, paper towels, newspapers, you name it. India, because of its much smaller wealth, the average person consumes a lot less paper. Well, paper is very recyclable, and so it makes a great deal of sense that instead of buying paper or paper products or paper pulp from Canada, the Indians would want to accept waste paper from Canada. Because they can then take those discarded newspapers and make them into whatever it is that they need to make paper products, right? And paper pulp mills are fairly straightforward technology, which can be operated in a fairly low technology, labor-intensive way, which works in India. Okay. Problem. Problem arises. What is that problem? Well, the waste paper coming from Canada, the bales and bundles and shipping containers full of waste paper, contain an unacceptably high amount of waste plastic. The Canadians apparently are not terribly good at separating their waste paper and their waste plastic. And, of course, this is partly because you've got all kinds of packaging, for example, which has got plastic bubbles glued to cardboard backing, or it's got laminated paper and plastic or whatever. But sometimes people are just throwing their stuff in the wrong bin. Anyway, it all gets bundled and baled up and shipped to India. And if the Indians open inspect it, or somebody in a third country through which it moves, sometimes places like Belgium, open it up and inspect it and decide it doesn't conform with the regulations, which limit the amount of plastic and other kinds of rubbish that can be mixed in with waste paper, well, they'll send it back to Canada. Well, what are the Canadians going to do with it then? They don't even know. And when it does get passed, it winds up in some place in rural India, frequently, and then you've got people being paid starvation wages. These may in many cases be the Dalits, the untouchable caste, but they might not be. But people being paid starvation wages who separate out, and to be clear, they wouldn't have anything if not for that, separate out the plastic from the paper. Then the paper goes to the paper mill to be pulped. And what happens to the plastic? Well, in many cases, it's burned for fuel in place of locally cut firewood or charcoal, which is great so far as conserving fuel goes, but not so great for other reasons, because although it is possible to burn plastic cleanly, that requires a fairly high level of technology, which often is not present in rural India. And so you get toxic smoke and all that kind of nice thing. What's the solution to this? I mean, I've told you before, you know, we can dump plastic waste and also organic waste, such as waste paper and banana peels and so forth, into a Fischer-Tropsch process, turn them into synthesis gas and back into the feedstock for making plastics. Sure, that would solve the plastic waste problem in the Canadian side, but it doesn't solve the paper pulp problem in India. I mean, we could just allow the Canadians to send all of their waste to India and then have garbage pickers separate it and have the stuff that's mixed waste or, in, you know, not easily separable go into the Fischer-Tropsch process and have the stuff that's actually paper go into the paper pulp. But, of course, building nuclear power plants, building any kind of nuclear facility in India with foreign participation is kind of a problem because India is one of the sort of de facto nuclear weapons states. And in particular, their explosion of a nuclear explosive back in 1974, their test of a nuclear explosive using plutonium that they'd made from their own uranium in their own facilities, but using a Canadian-supplied reactor to irradiate it in, which did not break the technical word of the agreements, peaceful use agreements they signed with the Canadians, but came very, very close, inspired a great sense of betrayal in Canada, and has led to Indian participation in world nuclear activities being very, very limited. So saying I'm going to build a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor in India, which is going to run a Fischer-Tropsch process and turn your plastic waste into something new, you know, that, again, that's a problem in itself. What about other ways we could possibly supply paper pulp for India? Well, one of them, I've got papers here about the agro-industrial complexes, which were discussed in the late 60s, early 70s, where nuclear power plants would provide fresh water for agricultural and desert areas, and they would provide heat for this industrial process and power for that industrial process and all this kind of thing. And one of the suggestions is making paper from wheat straw and other kinds of straw, presumably also. One problem. The so-called Green Revolution of the 1970s, which greatly improved India's fuel position, food position, so that it was much less prone to starvation, a key element of that was the so-called dwarf wheat, which produces a lot less straw, which means, of course, that you'd have to collect the straw over a much larger, not only would you have less straw to make into paper, but for each individual paper mill, which with a capacity of 100 tons a day or whatever, you have to collect the straw over a much larger area. And although straw itself is basically free, the cost of collecting it and transporting it is not. So I don't have a solution for that. But, see, Rolly asks, some papers do not burn well. Are those the ones with plastic in it? Well, there's also coated paper, which is coated with clay. That probably doesn't burn well at all either. So, yeah, those are problems that I would not claim to be able to solve with my usual solutions. On the other hand, there definitely are problems that we can solve with my usual solution, problems that are very, very urgent right now. You've got, and this is amazing to me, right? You know, the U.S. has been very, very much trying to ally itself with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been a key point in American foreign policy for decades now, despite the fact that, you know, Saudi Arabia was where the 9/11 hijackers mostly came from. That was where Osama bin Laden came from. You know, Saudi Arabia has not really been much of a friend to anybody. The U.S. has military forces, as I mentioned, in Yemen supporting the Saudi aggression there. Why? I mean, it doesn't make the Saudis take President Biden's phone calls. They won't. It doesn't mean that the Saudis aren't saying that they're going to take yuan instead of dollars in payment for oil, because they are saying that. Is there a reason why the U.S. continues to support Saudi Arabia? Well, so far as I can tell, the main reason simply is the fear that withdrawing support for Saudi Arabia would probably lead the government there to collapse and that oil shipments would be interrupted for a while, and this would cause a fuel stringency. Well, guess what's also causing a fuel stringency right now? Yes, that's right, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it's poised to cause a lot of other stringencies, too, because it's not just that Russia is one of the biggest exporters of oil and gas. Russia is the biggest exporter of a bunch of commodities, basically because when the Soviet Union collapsed, as part of the comprehensive looting of the former Soviet Union, lots of commodities got sold off, lots of things that the Russians, the Soviets had invested in a lot. You know, these facilities became available to the world market, and since you didn't really have to pay for them, their products seemed very cheap, and so projects for producing those things in other countries basically vanished, and that's been 30 years. There's been very little investment in producing any of those things anywhere other than in Russia, and so Russia becomes de facto the world's primary supplier, and when you cut off trade relations with Russia, you know what happens? You start running short of things. And the cost of nickel goes up on the London Metals Exchange to the point where they not only had to stop trading, but they actually had to roll back over an hour of trades to avoid the major brokerage houses becoming totally insolvent because the price of nickel was around where the price of, say, silver normally is. Bit of a problem there. So what else can we say? What else happens here? I mean, the other thing is, of course, Russia and Ukraine are both major exporters of grain. And if the Ukrainians don't get their corn in the ground, maize crop in the ground within the next 3 weeks, it's not going to be available for harvest this fall. And Also, they need to be harvesting their winter wheat right now, and you can't harvest your winter wheat crop when there are Russian tanks in the middle of your wheat field. And so you can brace yourself for a much larger spike in global food prices than you've seen already, although some of that is obviously being reflected in futures prices, which means that some of the rise in prices that you've seen is due to right expectation of stringencies. That's kind of the idea why we tolerate futures markets at all. You price in likely future shortages so they don't hit you all of a sudden. Anyway, it's not a perfect mechanism, unfortunately. But yeah, we're seeing severe oil and gas shortages. And so we've got the President of the United States who keeps talking about global climate change as an important issue, demanding other countries to increase their production of oil and gas, promising increases in production of oil and gas in the U.S. You've got people saying, oh, well, we need to drill for more oil. We need to, you know, drill for more gas, ignoring the fact that new oil and gas projects typically take 3 to 5 years to come into production. It's not something you can just go out there today. This isn't spindle top, right? This isn't the glory days of the old Beaumont oil field where you could go out on Tuesday and have cornered the world oil market by Friday. No. No, we don't have those kinds of things anymore. We've got these deep undersea wells, we've got fracking, we've got all these things which require large capital expenditures and take a long time to get online. And I'm even seeing, in the back of the Wall Street Journal, they're talking about, oh, well, coal stocks are rising, and they're looking at European energy alternatives, and, you know, they've got a big thing saying, cost of switching over from gas to coal. This is a terrible idea! It's very difficult even to get that much coal, okay? You can't just mine huge quantities of coal easily. Well, is there a solution for this? Yes, there is a solution for this, and it's called the Messmer Plan. For reasons I can only guess, the only country that actually implemented this was in France, right? Okay, so after the Suez Crisis, 1956, nuclear power plants were first starting to get online, and the three wise men of Euratom, a commission appointed to inquire into the possibilities of nuclear energy for Europe, suggested that Europe should start building lots of different designs of nuclear power plants on a large-scale basis to see which ones would shake out as being economic. Well, governments and industry did not want to put a bunch of money into something unproven, and so it didn't happen then. But 15 years later, after the 72-73 oil shock, the president of France came out and said, this is what we're going to do. Pressurized water reactors clearly work. They may not be the best, but they clearly work. They're plenty well proven by now, and we're going to switch over to them. And the result was that France is basically the only country that used less fossil fuel in 1990 than it used in 1980. Now, I could go on for hours about how if you were going to implement the Messmer plan today, right, on a global scale, you absolutely could not do it with light water reactors. Firstly, it takes too long to build them. B, there's too much of a supply constraint because of the pressure vessels. Secondly, they require enriched uranium, where they're inefficient users of uranium, and they require enrichment plant on top of that, right? There's a lot of reasons not to use light water reactors. My own preference is to start with CANDU type reactors, Canadian type heavy water reactors, and which can be fueled with natural uranium, enriched uranium, recycled plutonium, and thorium all at once because of their bundle fueling scheme. We might be able to reduce the amount of uranium per kilowatt hour of electricity literally by a factor of 5, which would greatly increase the amount of economical uranium available. And then we could start talking about breeder reactors. We'd only need something like 1 gigawatt of breeder per 5 to 10 gigawatts of converter reactor. That's something that we could solve. Right? That's something we could solve with nuclear energy. But yeah, I don't know. Again, I'm just sitting here looking around me, and it seems as though many people in the world have somehow come to terms. They have made their peace with the idea that maybe Pioneer 10 and 11, maybe Voyager 1 and 2 will be transmitting as long as their nuclear batteries last, toward a planet where there's no one left to listen to them because the civilization has collapsed. Well, that is not acceptable to me! I don't...
7, 6...